You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, which are the sole creators of the English translations of Rudolf Steiner's work and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider them in your patronizing. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Reimagining Academic Studies, seven lectures and a report, Collected Works, Volume 81, translated by Judith Wormuth Atkinson. This is Lecture 4, entitled Anthroposophy and Education, given in Berlin on March 8, 1922. Most honored participants, many repeatedly object to the anthroposophic worldview, stating that it requires people first to study and to develop particular abilities as a basis for accepting its ideas, and that consequently, from the very beginning, the results of anthroposophic research cannot be tested by everyone. In spite of this, it is claimed, anthroposophy still proclaims its views to all those who are unprepared. No matter how plausible this objection may sound, it belongs to the most unjustified objections that could ever be made against the anthroposophic movement. The goal of anthroposophy is not to turn everyone immediately into a scholar in the area of the supersensory. Its goal is to present the results of its study in a way that could be tested by all, simply by using common sense and healthy logic. This does not eliminate the need to put some effort into taking at least some initial steps toward suprasensory studies, for which there are instructions in various publications I have already mentioned here. Simply because of the circumstances in our contemporary civilization, everyone could become an anthroposophic scholar to a certain degree, but that is not necessary in order to prove the results of anthroposophic studies. They could be proven simply by using common sense. One of the areas where such a test could be made practically is the area of pedagogy. For a long time, very long time, the anthroposophic worldview existed only in the sense that it presented ideas when people asked about the supersensory. This was before contemporary cultural circumstances made it possible for anthroposophy to intervene in practical life. Anthroposophy is very well suited to helping in practical ways, but even this only became possible in a very limited area and to a very small degree when Emil Molt opened the Waldorf School in Stuttgart, whose administration I am in charge of. The short article titled The Education of the Child from the Perspective of Spiritual Science shows that already in 1907, before the founding of the school, there was an impulse to shape a school according to educational principles based on anthroposophic understanding. However, only after founding the Waldorf School did it become possible to turn these principles into practice and to apply the pedagogical and didactic aspects of anthroposophy. I will not be able to mention more than a few ideas in the context of these introductory remarks, but I think that these ideas can be developed further in the rest of the lectures today. When using our common sense, we verify for ourselves the things we perceive through anthroposophic ideas. We see that these are not simply theoretical views or abstract ideas, which we hold to satisfy some need for theoretical knowledge. What is expressed in ideas that have an anthroposophic source is real human power, something that concerns the entire human being, something that makes love stronger, and that could be transformed into a driving force for the human being. Although the usual scientific ideas and thoughts, related exclusively to the sensory world, are expressed in the fact that they serve theoretical and practical interests related exclusively to the sensory world, to repeat myself, ideas based on anthroposophic studies affect the whole human being. This includes the way we grow stronger, our capability to live, and our understanding of life. Such an understanding of life enables us to react to all possible situations by using our will. If we enrich any given aspect of life through the ideas of anthroposophy, and we let these ideas guide us, we will see that our actions gain more strength and become more effective. This power and effectiveness gain validity, particularly in the area of pedagogy and didactics. When the Waldorf School was established, we had no opportunity to choose the external conditions for the education and the process of teaching those children who were entrusted to us. Today, people usually make the point that if we want to have satisfactory work in the classroom and a satisfactory education, we must have an appropriate place for the school or the educational institution. Certainly, there are many arguments supporting these assertions, and to a certain extent, they are also confirmed in practice. Having an ideal space, however, was not possible for us. In the beginning, we had to start the experiment with the children from the Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory, accepting the existing circumstances. This means that we had to work with a very particular kind of children, and we had to begin our teaching in a building that, of course, was not at all appropriate, since it used to be a tavern. In other words, we were not able to rely on anything but on the pedagogical and didactic aspects that could be established on a purely spiritual basis alone. We should always emphasize that anthroposophy does not aim merely at an abstract knowledge of the head, but for an understanding of the world and its secrets. Such an understanding involves the entire human being, and it can lead to a kind of knowledge and understanding of the human being that cannot be achieved in any theoretical field. Ultimately, education and teaching are based on an understanding of the human being, as this is demonstrated in the relationship between the teacher, who is the educator, and the one who changes, who is the growing human being, the child. Therefore, our Waldorf pedagogical system is established on the immediate basis of anthropogenesis, the child. I will mention only one detail that can demonstrate how real understanding of the whole human being can prove itself in practice. Today we have a kind of psychology, more or less accepted by the acknowledged sciences. However, this psychology theorizes around certain questions that remain always without satisfactory answers. For example, psychology asks what the relationship is between the psychic spiritual and the bodily physical in the human. And psychology comes up with all sorts of theories. We have three types of theories. The first type tries to begin with the psychic spiritual and aims primarily at defining it somehow. Then theorists create some abstract concept of the psychic spiritual and begin to study to what extent the psychic spiritual affects the bodily physical. Another, more materialistically colored theory assumes that the bodily physical is the foundation, and that this bodily physical creates the psychic spiritual only as a secondary function. A third theory represents the psychic physical parallelism. Its purpose is to give validity to both the psychic spiritual and the bodily physical, and also simply to observe how the functions of the one occur parallel to the functions of the other, without elaborating on any inner connection between the two. All these are psychological speculations. They gain some substance only in living practice, where through psychology, through the knowledge of the psyche, we find the driving forces of pedagogy and didactics. In this area, the attitude toward the psychic spiritual in the human is simply not yet as advanced as the attitude toward the principles in natural science, which we are used to seeing as self-evident. In science, we can observe how somewhere there is heat, even though it was not produced in the usual way. We can imagine how this heat was first in a different condition, in the so-called condition of latent heat, and how out of this latent condition the heat became obvious. These principles, which are so common in science, should also be accepted, metamorphosed in an appropriate way, of course, in the observation of the complete human being, which includes the psychic spiritual. Even if some of us do not yet understand this at the moment, we will still come to such an attitude, which will be completely validated by science, if we look at the first major metamorphosis that occurs in the human organization, the change of teeth around the seventh year of the child's life. Such changes are usually observed only superficially in the human being. But the change of teeth is something that deeply affects an entire life. If we train our ability to view things in this way, we will learn to recognize that with the change of teeth, the entire psychic life of the child becomes different. We will also realize that before the change of teeth, children actually do not live, in quotes, in themselves. And I have in mind the real meaning of this phrase. Instead, children are completely dissolved in their surroundings. We will recognize the fact that the most important thing about the forces in the child's organism before the change of teeth is imitation. Children learn how to move through imitation. Unbiased observation will show exactly how the movements and gestures of the father and mother and of other people surrounding children are transferred into their very organism. We can observe that under normal circumstances, children also learn how to speak under the influence of imitation. We can see how their psyche dissolves in its surroundings, in the real meaning of this word. This, however, will not be the case during the process of the change of teeth. At that time, we will see how the forces that develop in children bring their capacity to produce independent mental images. This ability to produce independent images, which to a certain extent frees children internally from their surroundings, does not exist before the seventh year. Along with the change of teeth, the child develops some inwardness and becomes more capable of abstract thinking. At the same time, the nature of childhood determines the fact that children perceive everything from the inner life of the people who surround them. Thus, we have to assume that in the second phase of life, which begins with the change of the first teeth and continues until sexual maturity, the child develops internally by adjusting to the adult environment. What is impressed on the child at this stage is not what the people do or anything that the child imitates. Rather, it is what lives in other people, and what is expressed through words, the way people think, and their inclinations. All this is impressed on the child, no longer through imitation, but through the inner force of authority, to which the child has the same predisposition as to growth or to nourishment. I hope that you will not misunderstand what I mean here by, quote, the force of authority, close quote. As the one who wrote titled The Philosophy of Freedom, I would like merely to point out here that the principle of authority plays a role in a particular phase of human life. Therefore, it is not necessary to form the entire process of education around what we currently call the principle of authority. If we pay enough attention to such an observation, things begin to differentiate themselves more and more clearly, and we become more and more capable of observing the metamorphosis in the developing child, not only from year to year, but also by the month. So, what is it then that happens when a child, between the change that what happens with a child between the change of the first teeth and sexual maturity. Those who have an eye, EYE, for the facts, realize that between the ages of 7 and 14, and these are only the approximate ages, forces that earlier were hidden begin to find their expression in the child's psyche. In the first few years, these forces are hidden below, in the physical body, and they affect the formation of the human organism, including that of the brain. In fact, they affect the entire development of the physical. Thus, we can say that the spiritual human, the soul, which in the first 7 years is latent in the physical organism, but is expressed in each single movement, in each process of the body, is freed only later, in the same way in which warmth could be hidden in a body and be freed only under particular circumstances. After the 7th year, the physical is left more or less to itself. Consequently, the spiritual in us, the soul, does not grow completely out of the physical, but it does so to a very high degree. The change of teeth is then some kind of an ending point in the first stage of development, in which the spiritual in the human being, the soul, was in a way overlapping with the bodily physical. You can see that looking at things from such a perspective enables us to recognize the real connection between spiritual or soul matters and the bodily physical. At this point, one ceases to theorize about the question of how exactly these two aspects influence each other. Rather, at the first stage of life, we simply see the spiritual or the soul entirely within the body, as the development of children shows clearly. And then, later, when the soul becomes free, we see it in its own form. Thus, we do not start with comparison between pre-formulated, abstract concepts. Instead, we observe the work of the spiritual or the soul within the body at the different stages in life. This approach, however, puts an emphasis on the fact that the same phenomena usually studied in natural science, as if they are accessible only for the external senses, could be studied from a spiritual perspective as well. Anthroposophy as spiritual science is simply a productive continuation of natural science. At least that is the case when the natural scientific way of thinking is rightfully established. If we do not want to get stuck in superficial definitions, and if we want to analyze in detail the question of what exactly anthroposophy wants, then this becomes clear. If we gain deep human knowledge of the world of concepts and ideas through spiritual science, then any accusation that the world of ideas is alien to life is obviously refuted. In the area of pedagogy, anthroposophy does not wish to oppose in any way the pedagogical principles defined by the great educational theorists, especially during the 19th century. Anthroposophy recognizes that there are major and meaningful pedagogical principles, and it appreciates great educators as much as everyone else. Nevertheless, I should say that even though we have all those great pedagogical principles, currently people do not feel satisfied with educational practice, a fact demonstrated by the existence of diverse educational methods. Why is that so? Often, this is simply a consequence of the intellectualism characteristic of our time. This intellectualism causes more animosity toward life than we could possibly imagine, particularly toward the social areas of existence. In the world of ideas, intellectualism creates only abstractions. The abstract, however, has no life force. Abstractions are the corpse of the spiritual, to a degree, and are experienced as such. We may have the best principles that inspire us passionately, but as long as they remain abstract, they cannot have a really productive influence on life. Only when these principles are penetrated by a real and living spirituality that is connected to the essence of the human being can these principles become practical. Thus, Anthroposophy does not wish to establish new abstract principles of education. It wishes only to provide guidance in pedagogical and didactic skills in the implementation of the art of education and teaching. It wishes to offer what even the best educational principles have not yet offered, a spiritual foundation for practical implementation, for the inner abilities of the teachers to work in school and in education. For the very same reason, contrary to what is often believed, the Waldorf School is not organized in a way that enables us to stuff children's minds with our views of the world as we present them to adults. I must emphasize that even religious education is left to the Catholic priests for Catholic children and to the Protestant ministers for Protestant children. We have simply added another class, a non-denominational religion class, for the children of non-religious parents. Without this class, these children would not have had any religious education. In this way, we can achieve some awakening of religious feelings, because exactly those parents who would not have sent their children to any class on religion are sending them now. We put forth a lot of effort not to preach Anthroposophy in this class, but to build up what is appropriate to be fostered in children of that age. In other words, it is not about forcing Anthroposophy into children's minds, but about helping teachers to adjust, through Anthroposophy, their methods in a way that corresponds to a true education of developing human beings. We see, therefore, that through practical methods, it is possible to establish education and a way of teaching that focus not only on the child, but also on the whole development of the human being. After all, it would be silly to think that the feet or the hands of a child has now in childhood are already completely developed. It would be silly to try to force the hands and feet as they grow to remain the same as they were in childhood. Obviously, we consider the physical organism of a child to be something that is in a state of becoming, and that later in life will become something different. However, we do not always treat the spiritual development or the soul in the same way. On the contrary, often we see that children are being taught stern concepts, and we think that in their psyche certain things gain sharp contours at a very early age. This is wrong. Everything that we want a child's organism to become eventually we need to approach now, but only in a way that will allow it to grow, to keep changing. Later, say when the students are 30, they will not only remember what they learned when they were young, but as physical growth has transformed their limbs, they will also have the capacity to transform everything they learned. Along with everything spiritual that we offer a child, we must offer something that has the power to grow and to transform itself. This means that we have to make teaching more and more alive. All this can certainly be expressed as an abstract principle, but it can be achieved practically only in the presence of a really intimate knowledge of the human being. Such knowledge enables us to figure out from the nature of the child everything that we usually call the lesson plan or educational goals. Therefore, the Waldorf School has teaching plans and goals that are based on a real knowledge of the human being. These plans can be redesigned from month to month in accordance with the nature of the children themselves. We are trying to design education in a living spirit. I should mention one thing further. We can see great improvement now even in public education. Nevertheless, we all know that in the course of an academic year, a child suffers more than we realize under the system that evaluates the child's progress. On the one hand, we have the achievements of the child, and on the other hand, the evaluations of these achievements by the teacher. Evaluations are expressed in the following way: satisfactory, almost satisfactory, almost non-satisfactory, less than satisfactory, and so forth. I have to admit that I was never able to see the difference between almost satisfactory and almost non-satisfactory, and other formulations like this. To us who teach in the Waldorf School, it is important that at the end of the school year, children receive certificates recording their individual characteristics and the experience of the teacher with each particular child. The child sees a kind of mirror image of herself or himself. Experience has demonstrated that this mirror image, which does not specify satisfactory, less than satisfactory, and so forth for each subject, is accepted with a certain satisfaction and joy, even when there is criticism in it. This means that children receive potent evaluations based specifically on their own nature, from which come the ability to learn, and which can serve as guidance throughout the following year. If one has the necessary love to go deeply into the living nature of teaching, one can design living methods even under the most unfavorable circumstances. In this way, we can overcome precisely those abstract pedagogical principles that must be overcome in our times. One can find hardly any indications in external historical sources of the way the human being has changed during the succeeding epochs of humanity's development. Those who are sufficiently unbiased, however, can understand that the spiritual expression of the soul in the 10th, 11th, or 12th centuries must have had a character very different from that of the state of the soul in the civilized world since the mid-15th century. Intellectualism has been developing in our civilization until it reached a culminating point in the 20th century. However, like the principle of imitation or the principle of authority, intellectualism has the peculiar quality that it has transformed from a latent into a free form at a later age. We can see that people are able to progress from their basic nature to the intellectual nature only after they are beyond the age of sexual maturity, or even later. Before that, use of the intellect paralyzes and almost kills the work of the psyche. Thus, we can realize that we live in times that support only the adult, times that have as a cultural impulse a quality that can be manifested only in the adult human being. As a consequence, we no longer understand the world of childhood and youth, because we are steeped in everything that gives the tone for the culture of our adult world. This is the most important thing to consider in our civilization. We should be very clear about the fact that the same forces that have allowed our science and technology to flourish and triumph also deprive us of the possibility of understanding our children and of analyzing in depth the full nature of childhood. Now we need to find the way to rebuild the bridge to the young person and to the child. No matter how we see the different forms of youth movements today, they are profoundly justified. They are the cry of the youth. Quote, "You adults have created a civilization that we simply do not understand when we live in our primal nature." Close quote. The bridge between adults and children must be rebuilt, and anthroposophy wants to offer its contribution. If we move from a general cultural viewpoint down to the details, we will see that an educational plan based on the essence of childhood itself reveals to us exactly how the plan should unfold at the different stages of the child's development. Writing and reading used to be something different from what they are now. Look at our modern letters. They are abstract, out of touch with real life. let us look back at earlier times. In pictographic writing, we find something that is directly based on life. Today, we do not even think about how intimately connected to life this kind of writing was, and how alien to our modern life writing and reading are today. Yes, we are in the midst of a civilization where it is natural to put things alien to life in the service of civilization. If you look without prejudice at a stenographer or an elderly person sitting behind a typewriter, you would see that such an occupation brings life estrangement into civilization. Simply articulating this fact does not make us enemies of culture or reactionaries. We are not denying the advantages of such means for modern times. There are advantages. At the same time, we should develop counterforces that could help us heal the things that can only bring culture to a decline, to decadence, if we simply let them affect us without paying attention to the consequences. Real healing can come only from education, from teaching and learning in the classroom, a process that must be constantly redesigned in the light of the complexity of upbringing. When a child enrolls in the primary school, the intellect is still in a latent state. The capacity for abstract thinking, which must first be awakened, develops later. This is why we cannot approach a child immediately with abstract forms of writing and reading. Since there is a creative, spiritual principle at work in children in a greater and more perfect way than there is in any art form, we can work only with things that allow us to approach the child in a dynamic way. This creative principle works subconsciously. Thus, we have to support the subconscious and try to find special forms appropriate for the age of the children that will introduce them to writing through art, and thus will allow them to employ their full human capacity. Then they can take the next step toward reading. If children who are 8 or 9 years old are not yet able to read and write, teachers should have the courage to say, quote, "Thank God that they cannot yet read and write," close quote. The point is not that children should be able to do certain things at an early age, but that they learn in an appropriate way and at the appropriate age. This is why teaching in the Waldorf School is designed with art as the basis for every subject. This artistic pedagogical approach is the beginning, followed by a gradual intellectual development. We also take into account that music should be integrated into the classwork as early as possible, since it is related directly to establishing the will. To the classes of traditional gymnastics, also for will development, we have added eurythmy, an art of movement that combines the physical and the spiritual. We develop our methods as we go along to improve the pedagogical approach. However, we can see that this art of movement, which captures both the human spirit and soul, conveys something meaningful. We see that in these required classes, children adapt to the art of movement in the same way in which they adapt to language at a very young age, naturally and with joy. Educational development based on art allows children to experience colors as well from very early on. Even though painting with watercolors can sometimes be inconvenient, for instance, if we have to spend more time than usual cleaning up, we still see that such a method gives children a much deeper sense of life. We are doing more than simply helping them to, in quotes, get by. This approach requires them to interact with the external world. They develop a sensitivity toward the beautiful, toward everything that makes sense in nature and in human life. This is much more important than teaching children specific details from a subject matter. In addition to what I can describe here, which are only general guidelines, I must mention the anthroposophic basis of the teacher's outlook. When teachers enter the classroom, close the door, and step in front of the children, they bring along pedagogical, in quotes, imponderables, formed by their way of looking at the world and the human being. Teachers who use their living senses when they observe how children adapt to the surrounding world by imitation rather than abstract ideas, will know how the soul or the spiritual aspect works inside the child. They get to know the children, and their knowledge forms judgments different from the usual. When we look at life in such a way, we learn certain things. I would like to give you an example. Once the parents of a child came to me and told me that, to their surprise, their young son, who had been a very good boy so far, stole something. I asked, "How old is the child?" The parent said, 5. Quote, I said, "Then we should try to figure out what the child really did. It is possible that he did not steal at all." Close quote. What did the child do? The boy took some money from a drawer, the same drawer the mother took money from every morning when she was going to shop. With the money he took out of the drawer, the boy bought some sweets, which he did not even eat himself, but offered to other children. In this case, we have to say this is not stealing whatsoever. The child had seen what his mother was doing every morning and felt entitled to do the same. He simply imitated his mother. Only after the change of teeth can we observe a change in the child's attitude toward the norms of adults that are expressed as good and bad. Therefore, we have to establish a completely different area of judgment, and we have to learn that everything we do in the presence of a child has to be done in a way that the child may imitate. Children should be able to imitate everything they see, including the imponderables of our thoughts. This is how the reality of thoughts is expressed. Not only what we do is important, but also the way we think. In the presence of a child, we should not simply yield to the first thought that comes to mind, because thoughts affect the child. We have to consider our thoughts carefully, even if they are only in the form of imponderables. If we observe how a child deals with the surrounding world before the age of 7, we can see the reflection of how the child must have been before coming down to the physical or sensory world as a human being. Until then, as anthroposophic research shows, human beings are completely surrounded by the spiritual world, which is connected to them in the universe as the body is connected to the physical world. This is why in a child younger than 7, we can see the continuation of life before birth, or even before conception. This understanding must be transformed into a pedagogical sense, so that when standing in front of the child, the teacher can think, "The spiritual world has entrusted me with a being that I have to understand, and it is my task to pave the way for this being's life path." In a way, teaching and educating a child becomes a selfless service to the entire world. Through teaching and education, we sculpt something out of a particular system of views that have power, and without which there is no real teaching and no real education. The most important things in the pedagogical and didactic activities are precisely these views, which are based on an anthroposophic understanding of the world. While this understanding is not externally accepted as the norm, it is nevertheless rooted in deep internal work. Such an attitude causes us to look at the secrets of the child's body cautiously, in religious awe. We see how something created in the eternal primordial depth of the world reveals itself step by step in the movements and the gestures of the child. We realize that we must solve a riddle of life in a practical manner. Only in this way are we going to give the right direction to our entire attitude toward education and teaching. Anthroposophy wants most of all to see that this atmosphere, which radiates from all school activities, is present in the process of teaching, and that it dominates every detail in this process. However, in order for this atmosphere to be predominant, it is first necessary that through a deep inner conviction, we come to see how the Spirit works its way down to the finest detail of each sign of life the child shows. In order to take up and approach a class with the attitude and the skills that are based on internalizing the anthroposophic worldview, a teacher must come to particular understandings and develop the resulting abilities, and these should become instinct. I have been able to make only a few suggestions, which I will expand in the following lectures. The suggestions I made were intended to show that anthroposophy does not want to be radically against the major achievements in the area of pedagogy. Anthroposophy wants to offer some assistance, which would help bring these otherwise abstract theories into real life, into our daily practice, so that the art of education becomes a living impulse, an effective factor in our social life. The end of Lecture 4.